Welcome to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. With me is In Context military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
Hello, everyone.
From ancient times to the present, the experience of war has been one shared by peoples around the world. The objectives of people and their nation states engaged in war are strikingly similar. These objectives generally include territorial expansion, plunder, and control of natural resources and key trade routes. However, the manner in which people wage war can vary quite a bit according to their unique historical experiences and their cultural traditions. In today's program, we're going to focus on the distinctive ways Asians wage war. We'll do so by looking at important Asian military leaders as well as relevant aspects of Asian culture and history. An understanding of the Asian way of war is especially important to Americans today, considering the growing prospect of a conflict in the region. Consider the following. The United States is boosting its military forces in Asia and the Pacific and forging alliances with willing Asian nations to counter China's expanding influence. China and Japan are threatening to go to war over disputed islands in the China Sea. If such a war were to happen, the United States would be compelled to enter it under its defense treaty with Japan. And finally, there are reports that the Pentagon's war plans, known as the Air-Sea Battle, now include a scenario for a U.S. war with China. Marshawn, any discussion of the Asian way of war has to start with the great Chinese general Sun Tzu, who over 2,000 years ago wrote a book titled The Art of War, a book which is still studied by military leaders today. Marshawn, can you please tell us about Sun Tzu and his book, The Art of War?
There's a little debate over exactly how long ago it was written, but it was written ballpark about 3,000 years ago, over 2,000 years ago, probably closer to 3,000, during a period of civil war in China. And Sun Tzu was more than just a theorist. Like Karl von Clausewitz, he was an actual military commander. He had a lot of practical experience, and he implemented his own strategies on the battlefield. So he is considered the foremost military commander, the foremost military theorist. And his books are studied at the Military Academy at West Point today.
And what were some of the important principles of war that Sun Tzu wrote about in his book?
Things like the best defense is a good offense. Know your enemy and know yourself, and in 100 battles, you will always be victorious. And throughout history, you can see where his principles were not implemented, people lost. They say to ignore Sun Tzu, you fight in darkness.
There was a great subtlety to his strategy. And the book is a good read because it's not heavy with historical details. It's really kind of a philosophical treatise. And we can all relate to the rules.
It really is.
And one of them is that it's better to subjugate the enemy army without fighting. That's the true pinnacle of excellence. And I think that that's something that those of us who, you know, Americans who have kind of like a football player's mentality, straight on and hammer them, find it hard to relate to, that it's better to not fight and try to get what you want.
Well, it's not necessarily not fight. You see, there's part of the Western distinction is that we view it as don't fight, you know, either you fight or you don't fight.
Right.
But to the Chinese, they don't have that distinction. The idea of, let's say, another Sun Tzu principle, before you want to guarantee victory before going into every battle, that means that you have perfectly aligned your pieces. You wear your enemy down with insurgencies, with crippling economic conditions. You know, you cripple their economy, you cripple their industry, you wage a guerrilla war, so you cripple their military. But then it's not a avoiding war. It's now you launch an all-out attack once your enemy's weak. So the idea of Sun Tzu is that you want to guarantee victory by crippling and weakening your enemy before going into battle. It doesn't mean avoiding battle, but it means using subterfuge, using very subtle tactics to wear your enemy down. Sun Tzu was a big proponent of spies and espionage. So the idea of winning the battle before it's begun, it's very much a go strategy.
What is go?
The two big strategy games in history are, well, in Western history, are chess and the Chinese game of Go, which was played in Japan and Korea as well. Chess is basically, like you said, a war of attrition. It's like football players. We take the mentality of, I have the biggest stick. I'm going to bludgeon you to death. You know, that's the idea of Americans don't like going into battle unless there's a 10-to-1 advantage. That's what modern American military theorists say. A Go strategy says that you have to capture as much space on the board using as few pieces as possible. So the idea is that you're going to wear your enemy down. You are going to achieve territory through subtlety, through cornering your enemy. And then once you have him cornered, you'll destroy him.
Now, as you mentioned, Sun Xiu lived at a time of Chinese civil war. It was before there was a Chinese nation state. But the man who ultimately united China, the first emperor, who became the first emperor, his name was called Ying Zhen. And he later became the divine emperor of China.
Qin Shi Huangdi, the first divine emperor of China. You got to love people who give themselves now, that kind of title.
He was a great student of Sun Xiu. And he has one of his favorite quotes that I think really says a lot about his approach to war is the only way to survive is to conquer.
The only way for Qin to survive, the state of Qin.
The Qin was one of seven feudal states that eventually under his leadership became China.
And that's exactly, but that's an important distinction too, is the idea that there's only one way for Qin, for the Chinese people, because this translates over into the modern Chinese people. There's only one way for Qin to survive, and that is to conquer, you know? And that would be kind of like if the ancient Anglo-Saxons had only said there's only one way for the Saxons to survive, and that's to conquer. If they had said that, that would bleed over into the modern Anglo-Saxon mindset because they're the predominant ethnic group in England. Well, now the Qin are the predominant ethnic group and the predominant tribe in China. So to say that is the modern mentality of every Chinese.
It's expansionary. And a sort of related to that famous quote is one by his advisor, Li Su, quote, "Opportunity comes once every 10,000 years." What did he mean by that?
We're playing a game right now with the Chinese that we're not fit in. We're a country, 280 years old, ballpark? You know,
right,
we're a young country. They're, 3,000? Actually, historians estimate they might even be 6,000 years old as a civilization. 6,000 years old. So for them, the idea of something coming once every 10,000 years is not a remote concept. There's such an ancient civilization. For us, it's a...
We're geared towards the quarterly report.
Exactly. Americans have a very near-term way of looking at things. The idea that, we'll give guns to Osama bin Laden and whoops, he decides to turn them on us. Or we give guns to the Libyan militia and whoops, it ends up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. Or we give guns to Al-Qaeda to fight Assad and then we go, they're winning. They might get their hands on chemical weapons. So the idea, on the other hand, you have the Chinese who say that an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years. They will wait years, decades, generations for that opportunity. And a good example is that in the case of the early emperor, when Li Su said that to Qin Shi Huangdi, he said, an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years. He meant that this is the one opportunity to unite the whole of China. Now, for the if we want to look at a modern context, ever since the Opium Wars, really,
it's the 19th century.
In the 19th
British
century.
Chinese Wars. In which the Chinese were compelled by the British to allow the importation of opium in order to help the British trade deficit, and it absolutely devastated China.
Absolutely. And although there was an element of self-inflicted, and the Chinese remember that, because the opium scourge would not have succeeded if the Chinese people hadn't become addicts.
And Chinese merchants facilitated it.
And Chinese merchants facilitated it. So that left a collective scar on the Chinese, because the Chinese take responsibility. They believe strongly, and that's kind of the Confucian order of things, you know, a very strong sense of responsibility. So, and as a collective, you know, we collectively allowed this to happen. We will collectively never allow it to happen again, you know. But what's so ever since then, the Chinese have held a vendetta against the West. Well, particularly since 1949, they felt particularly betrayed by the U.S. China was first invaded by Japan in 1933. We sort of stood back and said, yeah, we sent them the Flying Tigers, who were American pilots who went and flew alongside the Chinese against the Japanese, but we really kind of let them get slaughtered by the Chinese. Let them get slaughtered by the Japanese. So to the Chinese, this represented not just Western apathy, but American apathy. We only cared when our interests were attacked by the Japanese. That's when we cared. That's when we intervened. And then afterwards, during the Chinese Civil War, just like we do, again, this is part of the very near-term way of thinking. Libya falls into chaos. We go, it's not our problem anymore. Or Afghanistan, the Soviets leave, falls into chaos. We go, not our problem anymore. Kind of the same thing happens in China. 1945, Japan surrenders, and we go, all right, wash our hands of it. See ya. You know, and we leave. And China plunges into civil war. We neither help the nationalists nor the communists, although we do start giving some arms to the nationalists. There really was a sense amongst the Chinese that the Americans, not just the West in general, but the Americans have betrayed us. They only were interested so long as they could get something out of it, and now that they're gone, they'll leave us to die. Well, so now all their hatred and anger at the West focused in on America. It really became not so much anti-Western as anti-American. Then what you have happen really from 1949, the unification of China as the People's Republic of China, onwards, you have massive American hate rallies where they burn effigies of Uncle Sam, they burn effigies of the U.S. presidents, and even after Nixon went to China, they're still burning effigies of the Americans. But the mentality of the Chinese was the opportunity hadn't come yet to really confront us. You know, the idea that, well, we're not quite there yet. You know,
well,
we're
they've come a long way because, of course, the Opium Wars leads to huge chaos in China. Then the collapse of the last dynasty, the Manchu dynasty, ends, and they're for the first time in over 2,000 years without an emperor. And out of this civil war comes a man named Mao. And Mao is a great student of Sun Tzu. And although most people know him as a political leader, he was in fact a brilliant military leader. Can you talk about his writings, his achievements as a military leader? If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context's website is incontextreport.com. And you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about the Asian way of war, a subject of particular importance today as the United States builds up its military forces in Asia and the Pacific to oppose China's expanding power in the region.
Well, Mao was very affected by Sun Yat-sen, who had formed the Republic of China, was, you know, a democratic leader, but he believed in the three principles, the idea of we first have democracy, then socialism, then communism. So Mao was a student of Sun Yat-sen. Well, one thing that influenced Mao very strongly was Sun Yat-sen reached out to America in particular as the leading democratic nation and said, recognize us as the Republic of China. And the United States, again, went, meh. And so China plunges into civil war. So what Mao starts to realize is that the only thing that will unite China is a strong man. So this is a man with no formal military training, focuses and dedicates himself solely to the art of war and the study of communism, but most importantly, the art of war. And he wrote a book called The Guerrilla Warfare. It is one of the best treatises on guerrilla warfare. And again, I'm not trying to justify the man was a genocidal tyrant, but he was a brilliant military commander.
What were his principles of guerrilla war?
His main principles were, first, escape from your enemy. So you're a guerrilla force, you escape from your enemy. And then the second is you establish a safe zone. Now, you can see this play out in the modern era, too. That's what the Taliban did. That's why they went into Pakistan. You establish a safe zone where you can resupply and recruit. You start recruiting and training. You begin launching attacks then on your enemy outposts, and enemy supply lines, once you've built up your forces and trained them. And then the fifth and final principle is, once the enemy has been driven from their outposts, then you launch an all-out attack on their major cities. Now, people make the mistake of thinking of Mao strictly as a guerrilla commander like General Giap in Vietnam. Not at all. He was very much a conventional commander, but he believed, as Sun Tzu did, you bring your enemy down to size. You know, your enemy's 6'2", you don't try to punch him in the jaw, you hit him in the kneecap and you bring him down to your height level, and then you punch him in the jaw.
He was at a great disadvantage in terms of the numbers of men he had, in terms of their equipment.
Certainly absolutely. Early on. Oh, and even later on, you know, after World War II, he was the one who had done most of the fighting against the Japanese, the communists had. And so, I mean, he'd been bled fighting the Japanese, so he was still at a disadvantage.
They had kind of an intermission in the Civil War. The Civil War actually went from the late 1920s all the way to 1949. But after the Chinese invaded... the Japanese invaded, there was a bit of a hiatus in the Civil War while Chiang Kai-shek and Mao presumably were cooperating, although...
Reluctantly.
Although, actually, Mao was very clever, and he used that time as an opportunity to acquire equipment for his army.
And rally massive support.
That's a critical aspect of Mao's approach to warfare, is that it's not purely a military adventure. It's a psychological warfare. You must arouse the masses through propaganda, organize the masses, disintegrate the enemy by trying to dissolve loyalties, destroy the enemy's morale. It was a real total concept of war.
Well, and also the idea that we pay for everything we get. You know, everything you get from the citizenry, you pay for. He believed that the peasants were the source of support. And still to this day, that's something that commanders have a very, very hard time grasping, that the people are the source of support for any military force. I mean, the reason why the U.S. is bumbling so badly in Afghanistan, especially with the troop drawdown, is we can't provide security to the Afghans. So we tell the Afghans, well, listen, you want to support us. You want democracy, this and that. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But the fact is that the populace are still, they're still frightened of the Taliban. They are frightened of the corrupt police officers that we put in charge, and they're frightened of the corrupt army officials. So they say, well, at least the Taliban will treat us better in many cases, or at least the Taliban will give us food and water.
How would you compare? I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so what you have happen is, as a result, the populace are never separated from the guerrilla army. So they provide food and housing to the guerrillas. Sometimes it operates through fear. The Viet Cong operated both through fear of the government and fear of themselves. You know, if you don't support us, we'll kill you. The Taliban do the same thing. But the fact is that if we wanted to really, I mean, if Obama was serious about squashing the insurgency in Afghanistan, we would need a million men on the ground, and we would need to demonstrate that to the Afghan people that, hey, we're the law and order. We're the force that will protect you. And we would need to physically separate the guerrillas from the masses, because that was Mao's principle. In order to have a guerrilla war, you must have constant contact with the masses, with the local populace.
Well, in fact, ideological training, as I understand it, was as important as acquiring military skills for his peasants.
And that's on another note, too, for his soldiers. There was a great documentary I saw, which I would recommend any of our listeners to watch, called Roots of Madness. You can find it on YouTube. It's a documentary from the 1960s, but it's a lot of interviews with Americans who had served alongside the Chinese communists and nationalists during World War II. And one of the things that they point out is when the Americans said to Mao, he said, why do you spend so much time on ideological training? And he said, in the U.S., we don't do ideological training. We train our men in the martial arts. And Mao said ideological training is just as important as – equally important, if not more important, than military training, because why should a man die if he doesn't know what he's dying for?
Yeah,
That's very indicative of the Chinese mentality as a whole to our warfare. They spend nowadays, even in their basic training, they spend long periods of time reading Mao's Little Red Book, ideological training. You watch Chinese military parades and stuff. They spend just as much time on indoctrination as they do on military training. But the fact is that a soldier who believes fervently in dying for whatever, you know, his cause is far more likely to win. And that's something Sun Tzu also mentioned, is that soldiers who believe in their cause are much more determined and will fight much harder. Soldiers who don't believe in their cause, or soldiers who don't know why they're there. And that's a great question with Afghanistan, with Vietnam, with Korea, throughout American military history. Soldiers asking, why are we here?
You know, after the Civil War was over in 1949, Chiang Kai-shek wrote a report, and he said that Mao devoted only 20% of his resources to fighting and 80% to intelligence and propaganda and psychological warfare.
Well, absolutely. During the Long March, they said the most important things for them to save were not their artillery, but were their typewriters and records.
Now, we have something in the American military called the G5. This is the civil affairs branch. How would that compare in scope to Mao's approach of indoctrination?
Really, apples and oranges. You know, the civil affairs, they do a nice job, but America has a love-hate relationship with the concept of empire and the concept of propaganda. You know, Americans believe fervently in propaganda, but they don't call it propaganda. They don't, you know, we go to a foreign country, don't indoctrinate, you know, we don't indoctrinate our troops. That's a bad connotation.
Well, it's an anathema to our democratic traditions. And we still are a democracy for all of its imperfections. And
well, yeah,
propaganda and manipulation is really runs contrary to that.
Every society is propaganda. I mean, you turn on any news network. How many times in the last 2 years have you heard Assad is about to fall?
Yes.
That's all propaganda.
Of course.
The only difference, though, is we label it differently. We try to be more subtle with it, but people aren't any different. So people don't buy the subtle propaganda as easily as they do the overt propaganda. And one of the things you see is that we show up in Afghanistan and we go, well, democracy, you should believe in democracy. And the Afghans look at us like, are you stupid? As opposed to when the Russians showed up and they said, this is communism. This is why you should believe in communism. This is why, you know, you should all be Soviets. And they used to have posters saying, communism is a gift from Allah. And the idea was that this was, you know, it was meant to indoctrinate the populace. To a great extent, it worked in Afghanistan for the Soviets until we started supplying arms to the Mujahideen. But what's interesting, though, is that now you flip that over to the Americans, and we really don't – civil affairs does kind of like meet and greets and, hi, how are you? See, we're not bad guys, which is good and important, but it's not propaganda. It's not – what Mao did was much more total. What Mao did was much more, especially for the troops, you know, having them read his little red book, the idea of this is what you're going into battle with, you know, this is what you're going to battle for. I mean,
and it worked.
It worked very well.
There's kind of a keep it simple, stupid rule about this propaganda, too. Is it you don't want to make it too complicated. You're not trying to get them to read Thomas Paine's Common Sense or something.
No, not at all. And a lot of it is, one of the things I think is interesting is in the army, especially nowadays, they have, you know, the soldier's creed, the warrior ethos. And what's interesting is most soldiers, as soon as they get out of basic training, the warrior's creed and the soldier's ethos goes right out the window.
Right.
You know, they forget it. It's whatever. But to the Chinese, that creed, that ethos, Mao's red book is so essential because they spend so much time studying it. It's not just a mantra that they recite. You know, because again, you know, Americans
believe it.
Exactly. American soldiers saying the soldier's creed. It's just a mantra, you know. Oh, I am an American soldier. I'm a warrior. I'm ever. It becomes like a mantra, but nobody really thinks about what it means. Whereas here, part of your ideological training is what does this
mean?
Well,
also we come from a more libertarian. I'd say people in the West generally, people in America particularly, have a libertarian tradition. Don't tell me what to do. And this whole approach, effective as it may be in the military for the Chinese, I don't think it would work with the American personality.
No, and I'm not advocating that the Chinese way of thinking is better. Far from it.
Yeah.
But I'm advocating that it is different. It's yes. Very different. The Western style of warfare and the Western style of not indoctrinating our troops, I mean, even when we look at the Nazis, you know, not every member of the German army was a member of the Nazi party. You know, not all the SS were members of the Nazi party either. You know, they were SS men, they were Aryans, but they were not all of them were Nazis.
So Nazi indoctrination is not... is not very impressive compared of the average person. It's not impressive compared to the Chinese.
No, because it's not as absolute as it is with China. Because the idea for the Germans was that their propaganda was Führer, Volk, and Vaterland. You know, the Führer, the people, and the nation. You know, the Fatherland. And so the idea was you were always fighting for your nation. Whereas for the Chinese, it's this concept of global revolution. The idea of Mao's thought must be supreme in the world. It's almost like a religion.
Yes. And he becomes, in a sense, the emperor, right?
Well, yeah, he becomes the new divine emperor and the new son of heaven. Now that he's passed, whoever's premier at this point in time is now the new son of heaven who will interpret the will of heaven, which comes from Mao. That's a fundamental difference between our two viewpoints on the world, between us and the Chinese. The Chinese also have a cultural superiority complex that's unique, too. For the Germans, you know, during World War II, there was a lot of propaganda, and obviously it was very heavy-handed. I'm not discounting the fact that it wasn't very heavy-handed. But again, it was a different kind of propaganda. Not everybody was expected to know Mein Kampf by heart. Mein Kampf's a pretty dense read. Not everybody was expected to read it. Whereas in the People's Liberation Army, you recite daily Mao's red book.
You talked earlier about how Mao killed a lot of people. Can you talk about the war against Tibet, the occupation of Tibet, which occurred right after he took power?
Well, the occupation of Tibet is, to me, the best example of also, again, how the Asiatic form of warfare differs. Because we see this when we go as far back as the first emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi. When we look at him, you know, it's a total and absolute form of warfare. And that's what makes them different. Also, again, from the Germans. The Germans marched into Paris. They didn't want to tear down the Eiffel Tower. Even when the Soviets marched into Berlin, they did a lot of really horrible things that we in the West would find appalling. But they didn't go and tear down the Brandenburg Gate. And of course, when the Americans, the Brits, and the French went into Berlin, they didn't tear down the Brandenburg Gate either. So on the other hand, though, you juxtapose that with the Chinese. And the Chinese go into Tibet. They exterminate an obscene portion of the adult population. It's not just simple genocide. You see, they view the Serbians and what the Serbians did or what the Nazis did to the Jews as crude and simplistic. The Chinese mentality is we kill all the parents. We force the children to kill the parents.
I say that again. They did what?
They kill the parents, force the children to kill the parents.
They forced children to kill their own parents.
Yes, because then the idea is that the child now being parentless, now their only parent will be the state. And moreover, they will be so terrified of the state, it will leave an indelible mark for generations on the psyche. You see, again, this comes with being a 6,000-year-old civilization. The Chinese know that historical scars remain in society. Again, something that especially as Americans, the Europeans have a grasp of this because they have their own historical scars, whether it's from the Mongols or for the Brits from the Blitz and Napoleon and all the rest of it. You know, they have collective memories. But for Americans, we really don't have that collective scar, so it's very hard for us to grasp. But the Chinese know not just what the collective scar is, but how to inflict it.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context's website is incontextreport.com, and you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe about the Asian way of war, a subject of particular importance today as the United States builds up its military forces in Asia and the Pacific to oppose China's expanding power in the region. They were aiming to, through brutality, terror in Tibet, to essentially make the culture extinct.
Yes. And then afterwards, they came up with approved cultures.
They reinvented it.
Exactly. And, yeah. So Tibetans are, they tell them they're Chinese. Well, Tibetans aren't Chinese. Anyone with half a brain and a dictionary could find out, look up Tibet and realize they're a different people. They're ethnically, linguistically, and culturally a different people. But the Chinese came in, slaughtered them, destroyed huge portions of the population, and then they say, you're all Chinese. And they import millions of Chinese farmers into Tibet, so they dilute the population. And then they say, you know what, you can have your own little quaint Tibetan culture and your little Tibetan dances and ceremonies, you know, because that's an aspect of how diverse China is.
You're right. It's probably how they would tolerate, let's say, the Catholic Church in China.
Exactly.
And my guess is they appoint the bishops.
Exactly. And it's much in the same way that, you know, if they were to invade the United States, what would they do? They'd exterminate huge portions of the population. And then they would say, well, you're all the round-eyed China. Those of you that are still alive, you're the children that are still alive, because the parents would all get killed. The children that are still alive, you are the round-eyed Chinese. You will now speak Chinese. You will have your quaint little, you know, maybe banjo playing, you know, once a year at a cultural festival, but you are one of us. You would learn Chinese. One thing that annoys me is people always tell me, oh, there will be a gun behind every blade of grass. No, there wouldn't. Because when the Chinese go into the first town and they kill every living thing, all of the adults, and they cart the children off to some re-education camp, the people in the next town are going to go, I mean, the equivalent would be if you rolled into, let's say, Greenwich, wiped out the entire adult population and carted everybody under the age of, killed everybody over the age of 12, carted everybody under the age of 12 off to re-education camps, and then you rolled into Stanford, Stanford would not resist. And that's the way the Chinese fight.
Well, we know they're capable of it because they did it in Tibet.
This is exactly what they did to the Tibetans. And the fact is, the world was silent. The world let them get away with it. We said, well, it's China, it's Tibet, who really cares? The CIA had some operations there to try to launch a guerrilla campaign. It was unsuccessful because every time there was a guerrilla attack, the Chinese would roll into the nearest village and kill everyone. Again, going back to Mao's principles, where you need support from the populace, there are two ways to take the support of the populace away from the guerrillas. One is to provide security to the populace and be a constant presence, so this way they won't harbor the guerrillas. The other portion is through sheer terror, slaughter the local populace.
How did the Chinese decide which policy to pursue? Provide security or kill people to terrify them?
And there's only one policy. That is terror. If you play ball, we will protect you. And you might get sent to a re-education camp. But if you play ball, you may survive. If you don't play ball, you won't survive. And people ultimately will choose might survive to won't survive at all. Their level of brutality is that unmatched of any I've ever seen. I mean, at least since the Middle Ages. And that's the thing. You got to remember, these are the people of Genghis Khan. I mean, Genghis Khan was a Mongol. But after taking over China, his army became predominantly Chinese.
So it isn't essentially inherently a racist view of the world. I don't mean to say nice things about what Mao was doing in Tibet, but if he would invade, let's say, Southeast Asia, those people would become Chinese eventually?
The Chinese differ from the Japanese in that the Japanese are racially xenophobic. The Chinese are culturally xenophobic. They believe that they're the central kingdom. Their culture is supreme. So anybody can become Chinese, but you have to be absolutely Chinese, culturally speaking, because China itself is very ethnically diverse. And I saw an interesting video that came out of China. It was a propaganda video, of course, but it was the Chinese national anthem was playing in the background, and it showed all of these people from diverse ethnic groups, people in the factories, in the rice paddies, Tibetans, and most notably, Muslims. Because China has one of the oldest Muslim populations in the world. A lot of people don't know that. Buddhists, Muslims, and they were all saluting the hammer and sickle, the red flag. And the idea was that we are a nation of many races, but we are all Chinese. You know,
if you're fighting an army that's following Mao's principles, how does a Western army fight them?
You have to be a people of immense determination. And that's one of the problems I think we as a nation have. You have to be a hard people. Who were the people that finally stopped the Mongols? They were the Arabs, most notably the Mamelukes. The Mamelukes were a hard people. These were people from the steppe of Central Asia. They were converts to Islam. They were the military elite of Egypt. These were hard people. The people who ultimately stopped the Mongols in the north were when they had swept through Russia and they gotten about as far through Russia as they could go. They burned Kiev and everything. And then they ran into the Teutonic, the Germanic peoples, and they stopped there. They kind of settled with sacking Russia. The only thing that stops this kind of horde mentality is a very hard, hardy, militaristic people. Juxtapose that with the American society, indeed much of Western society, but particularly with the Americans, we are in no way, shape, or form as a society prepared to counter that.
We are essentially a commercial people, individualistic, and these aren't necessarily bad qualities. That they can be very good qualities.
We've just never faced a war like this,
right? But that's not—we're not really geared for this kind of war. Although we have fought the Chinese, and I'd like to talk about the Korean War. Of course, at the end of World War II, Korea is divided by the Allies arbitrarily into North and South Korea. The northern part becomes allied with the Russians and the Chinese, and the South with the United States and the rest of the West. And then North Korea in 1950. Invade South Korea, and then eventually the Chinese become involved. Can you talk about the Chinese involvement, how that war progressed?
Absolutely. It started out as the North Koreans invade. They push us down to Busan, which is a tiny little enclave in South Korea. It looked like we were for the chop. Then MacArthur is his brilliant, albeit almost catastrophic, landing in Incheon.
This is General Douglas MacArthur.
General Douglas MacArthur. He got lucky, to be honest. He got lucky because it was just like the landings at Normandy. Had Rommel been allowed the SS Panzer divisions that were at Calais, we would have been pushed back into the ocean. And had Kim Il-sung moved his tank divisions to Incheon instead of ignoring the landings.
This is the North Korean.
This is the North Korean dictator, Kim Il-sung. We would have been pushed into the sea. So just like Eisenhower, MacArthur got lucky. After that, the North Koreans were then thrown back all the way up to the Yalu River, which separates Korea from China. And it looked like it was over. We had won the war. Well, the Chinese weren't about to lose Korea. So they sent in a million Chinese volunteers. Now, China was still reeling from the Civil War. So militarily speaking, China was not in a position to go to war.
Mao had only been in power for a year.
Exactly. They were not in position to go to war. But Mao was certain he didn't want to lose Korea because Korea has always been a satellite of China. That's just the way it's always been. So the Chinese weren't about to lose it. So they sent in a million men and they sent us hurtling back into South Korea. And yeah, Seoul exchanged hands three times.
This is the capital of South Korea. Yeah.
It fell into the hands of North Koreans. We retook it. Then it fell into the hands of North Koreans again. Then we retook it again.
How were they as occupiers? How were the Chinese as occupiers? Were they as brutal as they were in Tibet? What was their approach in South Korea?
Well, they more or less gave deference to the North Koreans, who were as brutal as the Chinese had been. Albeit, though, not quite as badly, but that was because they were their own people. They weren't a foreign people. And also the Chinese didn't want to culturally erase the Koreans. That's the difference. They wanted to culturally erase the Tibetans. Korea's historically been a Chinese satellite, so they don't feel the need to wipe out Korean culture. So they were brutal to the South Koreans only to intimidate them from ever supporting the Americans or the South Korean government. South Korean government officials or bureaucrats or civil servants were all executed and their families were executed. But there were tit-for-tat killings on both sides. We roll back in to Seoul after it fell to the North Koreans. The North Koreans say, we'll give rice, but you have to join the Communist Party. So people all went to join the Communist Party so they could get food. Then we roll back into Seoul and the South Korean army starts mass executions. So again, these were back and forth tit for tat.
Yeah,
massacres.
It was pretty horrible on both sides. There was something called the Bodo League massacre in South Korea. Executed 100,000 people who were suspected of being communists. So
absolutely, but that's again part of the Asiatic way of war. The Korean people will be pretty brutal to each other, but that's because to them, war is absolute. It's total. It's total war. And that's something that we, again, in the West, have always had kind of boundaries of what's acceptable and what's not. The Chinese had boundaries, and so did the Koreans, but they got past those boundaries pretty quickly. Again, their civilization is 1,000 years ahead of us in terms of they've been around for 1,000 years longer.
Yeah.
So their way of warfare is fundamentally moved more into the modern phase of total war than ours has. And so, you know, the North Koreans roll in, they round up government officials, they shoot them. Then we roll back in, and the South Koreans round up communists and shoot them.
And shoot them,
so
yeah.
It's, you know, but the difference was there wasn't a genocide committed because the Chinese didn't have an interest in exterminating the Korean people because Korea's a natural satellite, so let it be, you know, kind of a thing.
Now, some listeners may have seen Korean War movies, and one of the things I remember from watching them is that the Chinese and the Koreans, maybe it was the Chinese particularly, would attack in these huge waves. They seemed poorly equipped guys attacking a huge wave. And the idea was you would bury your opponents just sheer numbers. And it didn't care how many of your own people got killed. Was that an accurate a view of how the Chinese fought in Korea?
Absolutely. And this is different. I'd like to make this distinction, you know, for people who've seen Enemy at the Gates, which was a movie about the Battle of Stalingrad. Historically so inaccurate, I wanted to strangle the director, you know. I'm the worst person to go see a war movie with, by the way.
But that was about dueling snipers in Stalingrad during World War II, one Russian and one German.
I'm just making note of this to any potential listeners that might want to go see a war movie with me. You know, I'm just letting you know I'm a terrible person to see the war movies with because it was so inaccurate. But one of the things that's interesting, the Russians did send men into battle, every other man with a rifle, at Stalingrad because they just desperately wanted to repel the Germans. On the other side of that, though, the Chinese, because they have a surplus of people. To the Russians, it was out of an emergency necessity. Although the Russians typically weren't as concerned with casualties, the Chinese, it was a surplus of people, but it's also, that's where the ideological training comes in. A Chinese regiment was trying to cross a river, and they ran into a group of fusiliers, British fusiliers, and the British troops had their tanks, and they set up machine gun nests, and they would mow down the first rank of Chinese that tried to get across the river. Second rank would come up, they'd mow down the second rank. And eventually, the fourth and fifth rank were using the bodies of their fallen comrades to push ahead like a human barrier. And it was a myopic sense of purpose and focus that, again, we in the West and even the Russians would stagger us.
And they had the people to spare. You once mentioned the number of young men who become of military conscription age in China every year. It's a phenomenal number, right?
Roughly 20 million men and women, remember they conscript both, 20 million men and women reach military age every year. In order for us to win a war of attrition, we'd have to kill 21 million Chinese every year. If they got rid of the one-child policy, we might have to kill 40 or 50 million every year.
And to put it into perspective, our entire active duty military is, what, a little over a million?
A little over a million. And for and with our National Guard and Reserve, we're probably about 1.5 million, maybe two.
About 2 million max with the Guard, yeah.
And Reserve. For the Chinese, again, their active duty force right now is at 36 million. Just active duty. That's not including their security forces or all the people of military age who are in their National Guard because they have conscription. You go into like a reserve type status afterwards. The Chinese have the manpower to spare. And they're also not afraid of casualties. They're not afraid of casualties. And they're not afraid to die either. Like I say, the myopic sense of purpose, like the Borg, you know, in many ways, it's kind of scary.
Again, kind of the individualistic view of in the West that we have, which is fine, works for us, but it's not going to be good if you want masses of people to charge into a hopeless situation.
Our mentality of warfare is only going to work so long as we are militarily stronger than them. Now, if we had a Switzerland mentality and every American had a gun and we had fortifications and the bridges were ready to be blown up on a moment's notice, like in Switzerland. On Switzerland, all the bridges are rigged with explosives. They have air raid sirens everywhere. Everybody has a bunker in their home. This way, if war breaks out, Switzerland is a fortress. If we were like that, even with 30 million, 100 million, 300 million soldiers, the Chinese would never take us.
Well, that is actually one of Sun Tzu's principles, is you want to make your base impregnable. That's not an issue. And if the West did have that mentality, and that's one that's been put forth by some contemporary politicians like Ron Paul, and it was very much the line of the Republican Party until World War II by senators like Robert Taft, who wanted to, they're now derided as isolationists, but they basically felt we should have a strong military to protect the United States and not disperse our military around the world. If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context website is incontextreport.com, and you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about the Asian way of war. A subject of particular importance today as the United States builds up its military forces in Asia and the Pacific to oppose China's expanding power in the region.
part of the problem is what people don't understand is that the world's gotten small. So what used to protect us was our oceans as well. But now the idea is that, oh, we can have our armies over in the far-flung reaches of the world, and the Chinese will never come over here. Well, that's not true. The Chinese now can refuel in midair. They can hit us with ballistic missiles from moving submarines that are stealth.
So oceans are looking pretty small.
They're looking small, and they have the means to transport en masse millions of men. Like Li Su said, an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years. China needs Lebensraum, as Hitler once said. They need living ground, living room, living space.
Yeah, they're most, by far the most populous nation.
In a landmass half our size.
Now, we've been talking about the Chinese and of course, the Koreans as well. But we need to talk, too, about the Japanese. The Japanese are, of course, our foe during World War II, but now they're our principal ally in the region. What can we learn from the Japanese? Is their style of warfare greatly different from the Chinese? Of course, they have this tradition of the samurai, the warrior class, the tradition of Bushido, the code of moral conduct, which I think is distinctly Japanese. Is their approach to warfare different?
They're much less flexible. And that's one of the reasons why we were able to beat them in World War II. They're not as militarily very flexible. They love the surprise attack. They love the rapid lightning kind of blitzkrieg style war. But the problem is once things reverse for them, they're very bad at adapting to the situation. And that's why when World War II broke out and they launched the blitzkrieg across Asia and attacked the Solomons and Midway and whatnot, they were on a roll because everything was going to plan. But once their aircraft carriers were lost at Midway, suddenly everything went
wrong. After Midway, it was relatively early in the war.
In 42.
It was all downhill.
Had they won Midway, they would have swept across and taken Hawaii. But the fact is that the Japanese really had a hard time adapting when their plan went wrong. And so one of the things you see with the Japanese is they're very regimented, they're very militaristic, and they love the surprise attack. They also have a very strong sense of honor. An example would be, you know, if you imagine these two nations as individuals, the Chinese, you go up and smack China in the face, you pull on the tiger's tail, the tiger will turn around and say, I will bite you. Not today, not tomorrow, but when I see the opportunity, I will kill you. I will bite you and destroy you. The Japanese, on the other hand, you smack the Japanese and his immediate reaction is to kill you. So there's an element of patience that the Chinese have that the Japanese don't. And again, the Chinese will wait. When their opportunity comes, the tiger will eat you. It's not even an issue. It will eat you.
Are they also capable of the surprise attack?
The Chinese? Absolutely. They are fully capable of the surprise attack. That's part of what Mao's ideology was, and Sun Tzu, wear your enemy down, strike out at him when he least expects it. Hit what is weak and avoid what is strong. Ironically, hit what is weak and avoid what is strong is to hit our homeland. That was also another principle of Sun Tzu. If you get the enemy to send his armies to far-flung corners, the state of Wu was fighting the state of Chu. The Sun Tzu took the army of Wu into the state of Chu, and he marched on their capital. Sun Tzu had a smaller army, but the idea is now he forced the entire Chu army to back off and start coming back in. Sun Tzu was able to rip through the middle of the Chu kingdom because the Chu armies were all the way out dispersed fighting the state of Wu. So now they had to fly back. You know,
and of course, the United States today has, according to Chalmers Johnson, a very big critic of our defense policy, over 700 foreign military installations.
The vast majority of our military capacity is overseas. And I was appalled when I read that we shipped most of our F-22 Phantom fighter jets, which are our latest and greatest, to the Persian Gulf. Well, if we get hit at home, all of our F-22s are in the Persian Gulf, which means that they're going to be bugger all use over there if we get hit at home. And that's what the Chinese count on, is now you hit what is weak. They're not going to hit us in the Middle East because that's what is strong. They will hit us where we are weak, at home, which will also set us into a panic, which again is another Sun Tzu principle. But again, the fundamental distinction between the Chinese and the Japanese is the Chinese will wait. They will build up, they will build up, they will wait. And then when the opportunity comes, they will strike like a bolt of lightning. And that's a way to understand the Chinese. They will wait until the right moment, then they will strike like a bolt of lightning. You know, the tiger will wait and then it will turn and eat its prey. As opposed to the Japanese, who insulting their honor, besmirching their honor, calls for an immediate reaction. This also, you see this in the Japanese legal system with the samurai, was that if you insulted a samurai, he had the immediate right to cut your head off. You know, so it was, everything was very immediate. The Japanese loved the surprise attack, but their response is always immediate. What? When the Chinese, it was in Russia today, the Chinese had locked onto a Japanese naval vessel. Chinese war vessels locked onto Japanese naval vessels with their targeting systems. And the Japanese were furious. Well, the Chinese denied it and said, we never did that, which is part of the Chinese way. It was subtle.
Locking on means that you're ready to fire.
It means your targeting system is physically locked onto that ship, which means that all you have to do is press a button and the missile will fly out. And
the targeted person or army knows it's been targeted.
Exactly. You know when your ship, because all ships are equipped with countermeasures. So you have to be able to detect that you're being targeted in order to throw up flares or try to jam the missile that's coming in at you or trying to shoot it down. So what you see going on here is the Chinese lock onto this Japanese warship. The Japanese say, this is an affront to us. We demand that you apologize. We will not tolerate this happening again. And the Chinese go, we don't know what you're talking about. And so you're seeing the two fundamentally different ways of war. The Japanese, on the one hand, as subtle as they can be sometimes, very impulsive. They're very impulsive. They're very subtle, very calculating, but they can also be very impulsive. And this reaction was, they're impulsive when it comes to matters of honor. They're very subtle with everything else, when it's business and things like that. They'll be very subtle. But when it comes to matters of honor, they are incredibly impulsive.
And of course, now they have, in fact, been invaded twice by the Chinese. The Japanese have. How are they prepared for a war with China? What's the relative strength of the Japanese? Should there be a war breakout, of course, we would be brought into it as an ally of Japan. But the war might start initially between China and Japan. How prepared is Japan?
Well, that's the great mystery. The Japanese, like I said, when it doesn't come to matters of honor, they're very subtle. Before World War II, the League of Nations outlawed large naval vessels and said the Japanese could only have a certain number of naval ships. Well, the Japanese built the Yamato and the Musashi, the two largest warships, in secret. So what you see is that there's a pattern with the Japanese that they will build up their military secrets. They may, on the books, they have an armed forces entirely of 400,000, but they may have actually a larger force than we know of. The new prime minister came in with a mandate to rebuild the military, to get rid of the pacifism clause in the Constitution. The thing is, with the Japanese, the South Koreans, because also a article from Russia Today as well said that the South Koreans are threatening to launch a first strike on North Korea. What the South Koreans, the Japanese, and the Israelis all rely upon is that in the event of a war, we will come in to back them up. And they know that the United States is not only politically weak, but the U.S. president and the U.S. administration is weak. The U.S. administration will allow North Korea to bomb South Korea and then say, oh, don't do anything. Just be nice.
This is sort of contrast to, say, President Ronald Reagan, who everyone thought that he might be rash, but you didn't fool with him.
Exactly. Or even Bush. The North Koreans were terrified of him because they thought, you know, all it took was he had a hair trigger, and if he went off, you had bombers flying overhead. So what the South Koreans, the Japanese, and the Israelis all know is the only way to get to defend themselves in their eyes is if they start the war, because we're by treaty obliged to defend South Korea, Japan, and Israel. So if, let's say, South Korea launches a first strike on North Korea and bombs start falling on Seoul, well, too bad, so sad. The Americans have to intervene.
And we know the North Koreans now have missiles which certainly capable of hitting Japan. Maybe, according to the Secretary of Defense said, that possibly even the west coast of the United States.
Well, the missile got into orbit. So once you get something in orbit, you can pretty much hit anywhere
in the
world.
North Korea, yeah.
The North Koreans. And that was something very underplayed in the U.S. press. The whole situation in Asia is being underplayed because the U.S. right now is hoping Assad will fall, then we'll pummel Iran into the dust, and then we will demonstrate to the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans and the Venezuelans and the Cubans, we're top dog, don't screw with us, and everybody will be intimidated like they were in 2003. In 2003, we frightened everyone with our shock and awe campaign over Iraq. The problem is the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans have all realized that we're militarily very weak.
Well, to continue the contrast between the Asian way of fighting and the Western way of fighting, if you look at the 1991, our invasion of the Persian Gulf, or the 2003 invasion of Iraq, these campaigns were telegraphed so far in advance. It's like, giving the other side in a football game your plays before you run them because, hey, your team is so strong, it doesn't matter if they know what plays you're going to run because you're going to roll all over them. It's really an amazing lack of subtlety when you think about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you contrast that with the Chinese. They'll wait for the perfect opportunity, but when it comes, they will strike like a bolt of lightning. And I think the part of the reason why we had that choreographed mentality is because we knew the Iraqis would crumble. We knew the Taliban.
Yeah, they were
fighting
with like World War II equipment. They had been weakened by many years of an economic blockade
and the Iran-Iraq war.
And the Iran-Iraq war.
But the problem is
huge numbers of men.
Exactly. But the problem is now we're broadcasting to everyone, this is how we fight. Well, that won't work against the North Koreans.
How do Mao's principles work? Are they all changed by the fact that we're living in an era of the EMP bomb, where you can paralyze a country's electronics by exploding a nuke in the atmosphere, by the fact that they have these submarines? You can maybe talk about the advanced submarines they have. Does that change? If you talk about the submarines and how that may change war,
it only changes it in so much as it negates a lot of our technological advantage. But it's in keeping with Sun Tzu and Mao.
But the principles are basically the same.
Exactly. Yeah. The idea that, let's say, we have some of the finest aircraft carriers in the world. Well, the Chinese have been experimenting with EMPs launched underneath the water. Imagine if they were to,
electromagnetic. Bombs.
Exactly. These would be like torpedoes, though.
And they destroy the electronic functioning of the enemy's equipment.
And there was a ship, a civilian cruise ship, off the coast of California. The same time that missile was launched over the U.S. West Coast, this cruise ship was paralyzed by a sudden electromagnetic pulse that fried everything, and the ship lay stranded for hours before the Coast Guard finally showed up.
Yeah, some of the listeners may remember that.
Fried.
That was back in 2010. It was obviously a missile. You could see pictures on CNN of this missile going up. I think it was just off the coast of Los Angeles. And everyone said, oh, it's a missile. And then I think within a few hours, the Pentagon told everybody that it was just some kind of
chemtrail,
something from smoke from a jet. When it certainly looked like a missile. And then independent researcher Wayne Mattson, who was very familiar with this type of military technology, said that his sources indicated that it was an ICBM launched by a Chinese nuclear submarine.
Absolutely. And the Chinese might have launched a dud just to demonstrate they could do it. You know, and not for nothing, I saw the footage too, and it looked like a missile. And it would be more believable if the Pentagon said, that's just American Navy training up. Don't worry, that was us. No, to say it was a jet is such a blatant lie. Clearly, they were covering something up.
And their submarines are undetectable.
They've invested in this stealth submarine technology. First of all, the surface of the submarines is coated so that it's harder to pick them up on sonar and radar. It's also, they use a jet propulsion system underwater, which basically propels the ship silently. You don't have propellers anymore. The thing, it's like out of The Hunt for Red October, but you can look this up. It's the Russians call the Bure-class submarine. These submarines, what they do is they suck the water in one intake and then force it out another intake, thus propelling the submarine. Silently, though. It doesn't make enough noise for anyone to hear it. And the thing is capable of firing missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, on the move. Now, these are developed by the Russians. Everything the Russians develop, the Chinese get it. That's part of their military treaties. That's part of their technological treaties. And every time you see something appear in China, it seems to also appear in Russia. China develops a new stealth fighter bomber. Russia develops one that looks almost identical. So,
Marshawn, we're near the end of this program, but I just want to ask you one last question. Looking at the principles of Sun Tzu and Mao Zedong, if a war with China were developed, do you have any guess as to what would the scenario would be? Would it be over these Japanese-Chinese islands? Would it be an attack by China or Korea on the actual territory of the continental U.S.? Do you have any concept or idea how it might begin?
You know, that's a tough question. I mean, because there are several possibilities. Something could kick off between, you know, Japanese ship fires on Chinese ship fires on Japanese. It's unknown. They go to war, then we get dragged in. North Korea attacks South Korea. South Korea attacks North Korea, which seems like that might be a possibility. And we get dragged in that way. It's also entirely possible that China might launch a first strike against us and hit us at home. Anything is possible at this point.
Thank you very much, Marshawn, for your discussion. You've been listening to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about the Asian way of war, a subject of particular importance in light of the current U.S. military buildup in Asia and the Pacific to oppose China's expanding power in the region. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. We thank you listeners very much for your generous contributions to WPKN, which keeps this community station independent and strong. In Context programs are archived for free listening at incontextreport.com and at WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context. See you next time.